Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. This is Keith Pannell, and today we're going to be talking to two professors of psychology from the University of North Texas. Turns out they're a husband and wife team, and they are very interested in many aspects of mental health, disparities in mental health, treatment, the diagnosis. And so this is what we're going to be talking about and having a conversation about for the next 30 minutes or so. The guests are, in order from my left to right, Jennifer Callahan, University of North Texas, and Camila Ruggiero, both professors, University of North Texas, somewhere near Denton. So, welcome both of you to Science Studio.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thanks.
Now, before we get into what you both do, I want a very thumbnail sketch of how you got here. You know, you're both PhDs in some aspect of psychology, but you were once 10 or 11. How did you transfer, Jennifer, from being a 10-year-old to now being a professor in psychology? What were those few moments
that made
a difference?
I think when I was that age, I didn't know what psychology was, or a professor for that matter, because I had never met anybody from either of those professions. But probably around that age, what I did know and probably made a difference was that I liked understanding and finding answers to things, that I had a really nice teacher tell us that a smart person is one who knows how to find the answers. They don't need to have all the answers. And that really did set a tone of wanting to be an investigator.
So where did you go to college?
I went to college at a very small school, Jamestown College in North Dakota.
Okay.
About 800 full-time students. It's a little tiny place.
And so, but when you went there, you went to study psychology, though?
I did not.
Oh, what did you want to study?
I went to because I wanted to be a musician. And at the last semester before graduation, reality started sinking in, and I thought I better have a backup plan in case I'm not good enough to support myself. And so at that point, I had been taking a lot of psychology classes, and I could declare a major. So that very last semester, I declared a major as a backup plan. After graduating, I was working as a musician, but I had a career-ending injury, if you can think of it that way, that I developed Bell's palsy, which is a facial paralysis. And for a trumpet player, that's not a good experience. So that psychology backup plan became the way to make an actual living. And as I started working with my bachelor's degree, I fell in love with it and realized I wanted to go the full distance and get all of the training.
So where did you go to graduate school?
I went to the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee.
Okay.
By the time I was ready to go to graduate college, my parents had moved to Wisconsin, so that seemed like the logical place to go. And it wasn't as thoughtful as it should have been. But
so you're basically
there.
Way up there in the northern border.
Very cold.
Now you've moved down to Texas to the southern border.
Yes.
Okay. And Camilo, what about you? How did you become what you are today?
Sure. I think, you know, like Jennifer, it wasn't I wasn't 10 knowing that I wanted to be a clinical psychologist. But I think the moment where it sort of ignited, believe it or not, was even after going to grad school in clinical psychology. I think it's those moments when you're working with your mentor in a lab. That is the spark that sort of lit a fire. And I'm not sure I'd be an academic right now if it weren't for that spark. I think that a lot of people can probably share that experience of being, you know, sort of the passion of doing research one-on-one with a mentor. And that's where I fell in love. This was in grad school, believe it or not.
So.
I grew up in Texas. I grew up in Corpus Christi, Texas, and a little bit of Austin, Texas. And so I went to the University of Texas at Austin.
Okay.
And back then I was curious about a lot of different things. I was curious about economics. I was curious always about behavior and things like that. But psychology, it wasn't really until I started working with patients in the office of a psychiatrist that I sort of really began to take it seriously as something that, you know, is worthy of study and help. But there's also a big element of sort of social justice and caring, wanting to help people. I mean, that was absolutely part of the desire to go into clinical psychology.
Okay. So now we've got a thumbnail sketch on our two guests. Let's have a thumbnail sort of description of some of these terms, clinical, psychologist, psychiatrist. Jennifer, we'll have you give us some of the basic key definitions so that we can carry through this and understand the difference.
Sure. You know, in general, all of those professions work together to contribute to solving the problem of mental illness and alleviate human suffering, but they carry different training and strengths in doing that. And so clinical psychologists are often confused with psychiatrists because they are called doctor, and so that can be a little confusing. But for psychiatry, they're trained as medical doctors first, and they're able to prescribe medication. Clinical psychologists are trained in research and do not prescribe medication, so their training is in a very different pathway. There's, you know, within psychology, there's more divisions. And so you noted that we're clinical psychologists, and that's true. Clinical psychology would be a subspecialty, and it tends to be focused on the suffering element. So when you think of psychologists, you know that they may contribute to a lot of different ways of understanding human behavior. But clinical psychologists really kind of narrow in and focus specifically on disordered behavior or the experience of suffering, mental anguish.
So then for you really look at yourself as part of the sort of medical, biomedical sort of infrastructure of the country.
I think we see ourselves as contributing to the sort of health service profession broadly, yeah.
And are these people widely distributed? Do we have enough? It's one of the things I hear when I talk to chemistry people here or geologists, and they say, oh, you know, but we're overproducing PhDs. And it seems to me that from what I see in this country, we don't have a lot of people to help with psychological issues that are sort of being driven by our modern society.
Right. I think that's a good question, and it's certainly one that you'll hear variable answers to. I think probably the most authentic answer close to the data would be to say that there aren't enough psychologists where they're needed. So they're not evenly distributed. There are places where there are a lot of psychologists and heavy concentration, but then there's other areas like El Paso, for example, where there really aren't a sufficient concentration of psychologists. And so you really find that there's an inadequate workforce.
So the big cities would have a surfeit, and the smaller cities and the rural areas would have fewer.
Definitely.
But then there's the argument that says, but it's the big cities that create the problems that people have, and not the country and the rural areas. And so this doesn't seem quite as absurd as it, on the face of it, could sound.
Right. There's some, and that's an important point. They've done some studies looking at, that have plotted the concentration of psychologists in direct reference to the number of unhealthy days that are reported by people. And what you find is that when you have a low concentration of psychologists in an area, the average number of not well days per month goes up in the population. And it's not just for mental anguish. You actually start seeing higher rates of teen pregnancy, higher rates of smoking, higher rates of diabetes and high cholesterol and heart disease. And the issue is that psychologists intervene not just in working with mental anguish, but also in working on other issues that contribute to an overall healthy lifestyle, like treatment compliance and being able to face fears of going through with a treatment plan, for example, if you're facing, you know, something that is necessary but not pleasant.
You know, the treatment compliance is an interesting concept, and maybe we'll come back to it. But so far the conversation, do you want to add to something?
Well, just to, Camille, you know, the direction of that effect, you know, we have to be careful about, you know, why aren't there psychologists? I want to come back to an earlier point about sort of the cities causing the problems.
Right.
I'm not sure that's true. I think that data would suggest there's more need in rural areas, for example, and more unmet needs in rural areas as one example of city versus country. And so I think
before you get away with that as a sort of gospel,
sure.
Why do you think that? I mean, you've seen data.
Just data to suggest it. And I'm thinking of the Healthy People's 2020, where they looked at county-level data. And, for example, in Texas, I think there's I'll take one example, the opiate crisis, for example. This is a crisis that has really devastated certain rural areas of the country, and absolutely occurs in cities as well. But I'm not sure it's fair to say that cities have more psychologists because, you know, they are generators of the misery.
I'm sure you're right, but it just seems to me when I lived in London for some time, sure. And it's just the amount of time you spend doing things have to do in order to get to the place to do things you want to do. I mean, there's this total frustration all the time.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, just commuting. What is it? Do you spend an hour and a half commuting in L.A.? You spend 10 minutes in El Paso? You spend 5 minutes in Las Cruces?
Yeah.
I think, unfortunately, though, there are a lot of things that know no boundaries in terms of human suffering. And so when you're in an isolated area, and you know that you need to get help, not being able to access it can really make a difference. In some cases, between life and death, when somebody's experiencing suicidal ideation, for example, and can't find a provider. And for parents in particular, it's frightening when you know your child's suffering and you can't access services.
I see that. That brings to a sort of an idea. I mean, you know that you can pick the telephone up and call a number, and you'll be a voice at the other end that will try to play games with you depending upon why you called them. I mean, it could be something to do with your sexual activity, but is there not a drive to have psychotherapists at the other end of a telephone so that, in fact, this would distribute this expertise much more quickly without actually having someone to live in rural areas, as long as they're well-trained? I mean, is that not a development into the future?
I think what we're seeing is the emergence of telemedicine. And in our field, in psychology, we're seeing it as well. So there are now businesses centered around this idea of offering telemedicine. And I think we're gonna, the idea of what it is to be a psychologist, where you go and sit on a couch and, you know, just free associate for an hour, I think that idea is transforming. And I think that we, you know, telehealth is integral. Our program at the University of North Texas, for example, has begun a telehealth program where we're reaching out to rural areas. Even though we're not in rural areas, we can communicate. Oh. If there's a person who needs it, we can reach out. But it's not just telehealth. I think we're trying to use technology and leverage it to address mental health issues. And so I think it's going to be a different world in 10 years.
Okay, so the point about the tele is the fact that in your occupations, you need the visual contact with a patient?
I don't know that he would say that. You know, no? Relationships might be easier to make when you're in close contact with someone else. But I think for telemental health, one of the challenges is whether the person on the other end of the line understands the culture of the person they're speaking with. And sometimes they do and sometimes they don't. But particularly, I grew up in a rural area, and the issues of living in a rural area are quite different. And if I were to make a phone call to somebody who had never lived outside of a major urban center, they'd have a really hard time understanding my day-to-day experience. So it would be harder for them to be effective and empathic and helpful.
So there are limitations to long distance in between patient and consultant, for example. But it's a beginning that alleviates this maldistribution of professionals.
Absolutely.
And there's a fundamental truth in the sense, you know, we have, for example, if you go on to Apple, there's 40,000 different apps for your mental health.
Is that right?
Thousands of apps, thousands upon thousands.
Many of them very bad.
The vast majority with no evidence that they work. But relationships matter. And it would be impossible to ever replace that, the importance of a relationship.
I didn't realize that there were thousands of apps. Give me a typical one.
You know, a lot of them are sort of mood tracking apps where, you know, you chart down whether you're depressed or feeling, you know, so a lot of them are in that vein. There are some very good ones. For example, the VA has helped create one for PTSD. And so it's based on cognitive behavioral principles, but it tries to be automated. And some patients really love these because they're afraid to go. They have stigma. They don't want to go talk with someone. And so for them, this is a chance to get help without necessarily having to confront the stigma around it. Right. So there are some benefits to them. But a lot of them are just developed on the fly without much.
And some are for entertainment.
Like mood stones. I mean, I remember some years ago you could buy a mood stone and walk around with it and it's supposed to change color.
Right.
We'll come back to the stigma and the reticence to go to professional help in a moment. But we're going to take a break. You're listening to Science Studio. This is Keith Pannell. I'm talking with Jennifer Callahan and Camilo Ruggiero from the University of North Texas in the Department of Psychology. We'll be back in one brief moment. Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Camilo Ruggiero, Jennifer Callahan from the University of North Texas. And just before we took a break, you were talking about the stigma that is sometimes associated with ordinary people saying, I'm going to go visit my clinical psychologist or whatever. Talk about that. Why is that the case, whereas it's not the case if I go to see an arthritic doctor or something, a doctor to treat arthritis.
Sure. It's fascinating if you look at the prevalence rates of mental disorders. So there was, for example, the National Comorbidity Survey, which is a fairly rigorous study of how common mental disorders were. And the rates from that study were 47% of the population has something. Now, granted, you know, a lot of that is I'm scared of insects. I have a phobia of heights. I have, you know, so it's an arbitrary kind of thing of where you put the line of someone who has mental illness versus not mental illness. And there are different types of mental illness. For example, serious mental illness is a category we think about. But the idea that humans have problems, you know, if I were to tell you all of us are going to have a respiratory infection in our life, people wouldn't blink. They'd say, of course, I get viruses, I get cold. But the idea that all of us have mental health problems, that's a little more frightening to us. And I think that they're prevalent and they're common, but unfortunately there's a stigma around it. There have been.
Do you think that's changing a little bit as we are an aging society? Every family has someone at the older level who's suffering some form of dementia. It's true in my family. I don't know a family that doesn't know this. And so that may be going away. People are going to take more interest in their own mental state because they understand that, hey, wait a minute, I've seen my uncle or my father or whatever.
I would agree. I think it's changing. I think the stigma is going way down. Jennifer?
I think there's variability between illnesses, though, and dementia is a good example that nobody looks at somebody who's dementing and says to them, that's your fault, right? But if somebody's experiencing depression, there is a tendency to sort of look at that person and say, what's wrong with you? And to have a bit of an expectation that they should be able to snap out of it or somehow not have that experience. So there's some variability, I think.
I mean, depression is one of those terms that we all think we know what it means, but we really, I don't have a clue what it means, depression. What's the current sort of definition of depression?
Well, if you look at the Diagnostical and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, this is something published by the American Psychiatric Association. It's the most common classification of mental illness, and they would say depression is when you have 5 of 9 cardinal symptoms. That would be their definition. But at its core, it would be profound feelings of sadness, potentially anhedonia, where you can't have pleasure in things. It would be trouble sleeping. It would be thoughts of suicide that you don't, you know, that you should, thoughts of killing yourself.
All of this sustained over a period of time.
Sustained
though.
Over
so
a period.
Not a bad day,
Precisely because... Well, apart
sure.
from suicide, I think I've had some of those.
Well, even things like suicide, it's not uncommon for people to have brief transitory ideas of, gosh, I wish I were, you know, I'd be better off to, you know, these are common experiences to have, but to have them, as Jennifer said, sustained over a period of weeks and months. And
where
to the point,
it's actually impacting your functioning.
It profoundly, it impacts your relationships in serious ways or your job or things like that.
I mean, you think about a married couple. I mean, they live with one another. They know one another well. They can see each other very well. I mean, do you get anecdotally or statistically from papers, do many spouses report their spouse and say, look, I see that my husband is doing this unusual behavior. I'm worried about depression, or vice versa. Because that would be the place where you would think you would see it first. But there's, I'm sure, a great tendency not to do that.
Well, absolutely. I think a lot of times people do go get treatment because they think they're doing okay, but their spouses say, no, you need to get help. So I think spouses do play an
important role. So you do see that quite often.
Oh, absolutely. Like in the case of dementia that you're saying, it's not typically the elder person who knows that there's something not going well. It's usually a family member who starts to see changes that are important.
Right.
Just to joke a little bit, though, I think when you have 2 clinical psychologists in a marriage, we're very quick to diagnose one another. You just need to turn up the heat a little bit and get a conflict going, and we're ready.
Yeah, we'll change topics. Let's go to the whole concept of nowadays. I mean, I see that you're interested in mental health disparities. What that usually means, like health disparities, the difference between provision of health, the need for health treatment in African-American, Hispanics, Anglos, Pacific Islanders. I'm sure I'm leaving somebody out. But the point is, tell us a little bit about that. Is there a big difference between one group of this society and another in terms of their ability or confidence and comfort level in going to a clinical psychologist that's actually been documented?
Sure. I think when you look at the straight-up prevalence rates of mental health problems in different and I'm going to speak about racial ethnic for now, but when we talk about disparities, there's lots of different types of disparities. I'll confine myself to talking about racial and ethnic disparities for now. But you see that the prevalence rates are not vastly different. So, for example, prevalence rates of mental health among Hispanics tends to be slightly lower in some national surveys than it is for other groups. So there's variability in that. But where you really begin to see disparities is in access, in who has insurance, who's able to go get care. When they go get care, their ability to sort of stick with care and feel comfortable getting care. I think that in terms of mental health problems is where you begin to really see the disparities. Now, there are other types of health disparities, physical ones that we're not going to talk about. But I would argue that might be the biggest sort of problem is access to care. Jennifer, do you?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. The only thing I would add on to that is the role of a language barrier.
Sure.
And so one of the things we know is that if you don't speak English, it is much harder to access care. And I think there's some data to show that the length of time can run as long as 11 to 13 years, in which case, you know, that's a lot of disruption to someone's life. So I think that's kind of an extra layer that often coincides with race and ethnicity.
So this famous concept of the macho culture of from Mexico and then presumably carried over to Hispanics of Mexican-American heritage, is that true? From what you can see, that a man says, I can't possibly have a mental issue and I'm not going to see this damn doctor, whatever his name is.
So I haven't looked extensively for this data, but I have seen one study where they had surveys and asked about attitudes like this. And it wasn't the whole story by any means. I think issues of cost were the bigger story. But absolutely, there was an element in some of these surveys that I don't want to go get care because I'm not crazy. I don't want to be perceived as crazy. I don't.
Well, it's also, I think, a good psychotherapeutic relationship is pretty intimate in nature. And so there's a level of vulnerability there that can be unsettling to somebody who's not used to engaging in kind of a more emotionally intimate space.
Well, one of my ex-students was, she was from Mexico. And before you can practice medicine down there or any other career, you have to do a year of servicio social, which means that before you get your certificate that allows you to set up as an MD or whatever, chemist even, you've got to go and spend a year doing work for the common good. And she was put on this famous Chihuahua Pacifico Railroad with a little cabin where she was mainly treating ladies for gynecological issues and the rest, but also was distributing condoms all over the place to the railway workers. And then she sort of came across a place called Pito Real. It's up in the Tarahumara area. And she said that now she was treating the indigenous Tarahumara. Never saw a man until he was almost dead. I mean, it was just this reticent of the males in this indigenous grouping, which is not, I think, particularly well known for the macho concept, but it's a male thing. Do you see that in medicine in general? Women, men have different attitudes towards getting help?
You know, it's hard to say for sure, but I will tell you just from people that I know, so this isn't so much a result of citing any study or anything, is that when you mentioned dementia earlier, that a lot of the people that have known over time have said it's much easier to bring mom in than it is to bring dad in.
Yeah.
That dads are reluctant to be identified as needing any help from their children. You know, that's a counter expectation to their role in the family. And so I think cross-culturally, I've seen that phenomenon.
Okay. And you see it also, Camilo?
Absolutely. I think there's more reticence, you know, this idea of sort of being intimate and sharing your problems. There tends to be a gender difference in how comfortable people feel. You know?
Okay, we've got 4 minutes left, so I'm going to give you 2 minutes each. I want to know what it is your research is focused on right this minute. So, Jennifer, what's your big current bee on your bonnet for research?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's the sort of thing that you wake up in the morning and feel driven by, right? And so as I'm a psychotherapy researcher, kind of by training, And so we know we have a lot of great psychotherapies that work quite effectively, and yet we still see such high rates of suffering across the population. So the thing that's been driving me most is trying to figure out how to better place the needed resources within proximity to the people who need them. And so some of that work is trying to work on training students. Some of it's working on getting evidence-based resources to providers who are already serving the public. And still other aspects are trying to understand what needs to change with existing treatments so that they're more palatable to people who are reluctant to engage in them for one reason or another.
Okay. And Camila, what would be your current bee in your bonnet?
Sure. I would speak as a field that certain diseases have come into existence. I'm thinking of HIV, and we have made tremendous strides in those areas as a society, as medical fields. The same is not true in the world of mental health, that we continue to have prevalence. If anything, if you look at, for example, suicide rates, they're slightly creeping up a little bit. This is terrifying and exhilarating as a scientist, a clinical scientist. It's exhilarating in the sense, not the, please don't. It's exhilarating in the sense of how much there is to be done in sort of making progress and tackling some of these things. So I think it's just as a field, I think what we don't know is also an opportunity to do great work. And I would encourage anyone listening who's a younger person, this is an area where they can make a huge impact on society, on the well-being of people. And it's desperate. It is not a backwater of science. It needs to be at the forefront of what we're doing as a society. So I'm excited by this prospect.
Why do you say it's an emergency? Because just listening to you and watching you, you think this is just around the corner as a disaster. It's as bad as this coronavirus, which is supposed to be creeping all over, which has got nothing compared to flu. But why do you think there's this emergency?
It is probably one of the most prevalent conditions that we face. The amounts of disability that stem from mental illness are tremendous. It has a toll on billions of people are affected by these problems. As a society, I don't think we appreciate the scope of how important these things are. And instead, the coronavirus is terrifying. I'm not trying to diminish the importance of that. But in terms of the impact on numbers of people in the world, clearly things like depression have a much bigger impact.
Okay.
And that's the emergency, that I don't think people appreciate how important this area is.
The implication of that is that depression and all those various aspects of mental health is not just a developed nation issue. I mean, you say around the world. I mean, is that totally,
well,
is it a big deal in Rwanda? Is that a big deal in Botswana?
There are clearly more immediate needs of survival that matter in certain places. So it is more of a developed nations crisis, things like depression.
Right.
But it is around the world, and things, serious mental illness affects people globally.
Okay. If there's anybody out there going to listen in Botswana, send me an email. It's kpanel@utep.edu. We'd like to hear from you. Jennifer Callahan, thank you so much for being here on Science Studio. Camila Ruggiero, thank you also. Both faculty members at the University of North Texas, the home of the Mean Green. And we'll be back next week with another Science Studio. Bye-bye.